Samantha, do you recognize what I have on the screen here? Right. Kyle, do you recognize that experiment? Chris? Melissa? Easter? Lisa? You watched the video of Tuesday's lecture, didn't you?
Mm-hmm.
Matt, you recognize that experiment? Anyways, want to point out at the beginning, just at the top, because today's going to be a really fun day. Mike, question? Okay. Just point out from the top that much of what I talk about and what you learn about in discussion is in your textbook. And it's outlined in terms of what you have to read in glowing detail in your syllabus. Come on in, Anton. Take your usual spot next to Sky. And we'll shuffle in about a week or two. In any case, please read your text. I really picked this text out because it's designed for mainly people who are not going into science. And just about everything that we talk about is in this text in very, very easy reading, very, very conceptual. And so I was kind of surprised on Tuesday because I went over that experiment, but I knew that it was in your text. And I just was sort of curious to see how many people had read it or not. And I think it really, I want to say something, and I'm not going to say very much. I just want to say, again, this is all about you. Keep that in mind. You know, this class is for you guys. And so the more you put in, and I know you're working all very hard, but the more you put in, the more you're going to get out. And as I said 3 weeks ago, you're going to get more out of this class than five other classes that you take at this university. So please read the text. That was the first thing I had to say. Second thing that I had to say was that if you notice in the syllabus, there's only one real requirement other than coming to class and stuff like that, and that is that the Thursday guest speakers and movie discussion and discussion is all mandatory. And you'll notice that you're not allowed to miss more than two during the quarter, that is discussions and or guest speaker discussions and or film discussions. And so please read that little paragraph. And if you can't make class for whatever reason, whether it's a Tuesday or a Thursday or a Wednesday, just let me know, because sometimes I look forward to seeing some of you guys and have a game plan put into place. And when you don't come, then I'm, you know, like our buddy Jordan isn't here. So the point here is that I notice everybody because I know all of your names. And, you know, it's one big family. But seriously, attendance is mandatory. And if you can't come for whatever reason, and some of you have to leave early and stuff, and you all talk to me, and I really appreciate it because it's, you know, it's professional. Quiz is due tomorrow night at midnight. I will be there. If any of you want to talk to me, I'll be available. Shut off your cell phone. And I missed office hours yesterday, so you can talk to me tomorrow night. And if you come after midnight, we can stay till 1, we can stay till 2, we can stay till 3, we can go running at 4. I don't mind. I don't have anything to do except all the work that I'm doing. Now, are there any questions about anything so far? Okay. Yesterday you had a discussion on genetically modified plants in animals. And so, and many issues were raised. Ethical issues, issues of using the technology for the poor, issues of, you know, is this natural, is it not natural? All kinds of different issues were raised. And so today we have a guest speaker, Dr. Alan McEwen, who I introduced right back there, who's an expert at this, as I told you on Tuesday. And he'll be talking after we show you a film, which I hope you enjoy. And if you don't, feel free to throw bananas and apples and everything else. And this film is going to go for approximately an hour. And then we're going to take a very short break. And by the way, don't be bashful, you know, because I tend to pontificate a little bit. And if you guys need a break, just raise your hand and say, please give us a break. There's no, you know, we're all equal in here. Don't be bashful or shy. Say, let's take a break, and I'm happy to take a break at any time you want. So just keep that in mind. So we're going to have the film, and then after the film, Alan's going to give a talk, and then he's going to have questions and answers. Then we're going to have a reception for Alan right outside. And then those of you who are going to dinner are going to come to the faculty center, okay? So, Mike, do you know how to work this, or someone's got to help me? Jack? Do I need to turn the computers off, or what do I need to do?
No.
Turn this over to DVD, okay? There we go. Put it in, and now what happens?
Should play.
You sure? Got it? Know how to play it? Got the menu? What's going on? I have no clue. Play.
Good.
Got it.
In America today, we produce more food than ever before. So you might think that we have less reason to worry about food.
I'll get it. Genetic engineering from various counties in the state of California. And he's rather unique in being able to do this because he's a plant molecular geneticist, having a PhD from Oxford in England and done postdoctoral work at Yale in the United States in plant molecular biology and genetics, and then was a professor at the University of Saskatchewan for 20 years. Before moving to the University of California, Riverside, where he is dealing with research. He has research that he does, but he's also dealing with communicating to the public all over the state of California and elsewhere about genetically modified organisms and various points thereof. And finally, I just want to remind you, as I told you on Tuesday, Alan's done a lot of stuff. He's been on a lot of committees that have dealt with the environmental impacts and the risks and benefits of this technology, both in Canada and in the United States, and participated in the last National Academy of Sciences committee and report, as I showed you on Tuesday, on the health effects of genetically modified plants. And so he's probably one of the best individuals, not only locally, but in California, but in the United States and in the world, because he participates in many, many, many forums, in Europe, Canada, here, everywhere. Last time I saw him, we bumped into each other at the airport, and I was on my way to Washington. He was on his way to Thailand for some commission that he was on, or research talk, I'm not quite sure what. But the point here is that you have a novel opportunity to listen to someone who's balanced, fair, knows the arguments, and would be willing to address at some particular point when he's through giving his talk any of the things that you might want to raise or any of the things that you might want to discuss. And so let's give a very, very, very warm welcome to Dr. Alan McEwen. All yours, my man.
Thank you. Well, thanks very much. Always a pleasure to see you. Always a pleasure to come and talk to your students. You know, before I get into it, I just I bet you probably didn't realize that your prof was a movie star. But beyond that, Bob is an inspiration to the scientific community for two reasons. And those admirable reasons, things that I try to emulate, he defends science and, in fact, is a champion of solid science. Nothing makes Bob more angry than seeing junk science or sloppy science. So if you think you can get away with that, don't push him. The second feature that I truly admire in Bob and try to emulate myself is that he is totally dedicated to you. And, you know, he said earlier that if you want to spend time with him going over stuff and it goes late into the night and goes at 1 o'clock in the morning, 2 o'clock, he means that. So feel free to call him 24 hours a day. And if you have discussion questions, he's open to that. And I think it's truly remarkable. It's very difficult to find somebody that dedicated these days. So keep it up, Bob. Okay. Have you had a pop quiz yet? Okay. We have. Oh, good. We have another pop quiz. We're going to start with a pop quiz. The Food Policy Institute conducted a survey a couple of years ago. You know, just paper, pencil. You know, I'm not going to grade these. You can grade them yourselves later. But some of the questions that came from this survey I pulled out. You know, you've all heard of GMOs. You're taking biotechnology. You understand something about genetics. And even if you're not scientists, you're going to hear genetic technologies, not just in agriculture and food production, but in any number of different aspects in normal day-to-day living, right? The Food Policy Institute was concerned with the public's state of knowledge, particularly with genetically modified foods, or GMOs. So they conducted a survey in 2004, and some of the questions they asked our great American populace included, are genetically modified foods in the marketplace? Yes or no? Right? Flip a coin if you have to. Do ordinary tomatoes contain genes? Would a tomato with a fish gene taste fishy? If you ate a genetically modified fruit, would it alter your own genes? Keeping up with me. Is it possible to transfer a gene from an animal into a plant? Bob, I notice you're not taking the test here. Give an example of genetically modified food on the market. Okay, let's go through these questions again, and we'll see how you score compared with a random sample of Americans. Right, the questions again, if you need them, and the answers, and I've indicated here the percentage of American respondents to this survey who got the answer correct. Right, I'm not going to give you the correct answer. 48% recognize that genetically modified foods are currently in our marketplace. Right? You can eat genetically modified foods. Only 40% correctly recognize that tomatoes contain genes. This is funny, right? 42% correctly recognized that a tomato with a fish gene would not taste fishy. Right? Still tastes like a tomato. 45% correctly recognized that eating a GM food does not necessarily change your own genes. Right? These things are not mutagenic. Only 30% correctly recognized that, yes, it was technically possible to take a gene from an animal and put it into a plant. And then finally, 79% of those people who said there was genetically modified food on the market identified tomatoes. The problem is, there are no tomatoes on the market genetically modified, at least not using recombinant DNA technologies or genetic engineering. So these results are kind of scary. When you consider that for, you know, the first five questions, the results are binary, right? It's either yes or no. And more than half the respondents, more than half our citizens, got these wrong. Now, you'd figure that if they didn't know the answer and they were just guessing, flipping a coin, the results would be all closer to 50%, right? So this isn't pure ignorance. What's actually happening here is that people are saying, okay, I don't have to guess, I know the answer. If they were guessing, it would be closer to 50%, but I know the answer. And they put down the wrong answer. So it's not just that the people don't know and they're guessing and inform me, it's that I don't need to learn anymore, I know the answer. And that's arrogance combined with ignorance, which is really scary as an educator to have to deal with. I hope you've done better than the average of our local citizens or American citizens. Biotech is particularly susceptible to ignorance and misinformation. And again, as informed citizens, you don't have to be scientists, right? But you do have to think or recognize scientific processes and think like a scientist sometimes in order to make informed decisions as to whether you wish to buy these products in your market or not. And I know there's a number of people who will say to me, you know, I don't like GMOs, I'm not going to buy them in the market for various reasons. And very often the reason they give me is incorrect. I mean, it's not because of their belief, but it's factually incorrect. At the same time, I occasionally encounter people who say, look, this is wonderful. We should genetically engineer everything, right? I mean, the food is so much better, it's cheaper, it's better for the environment, it's non-toxic, there's nothing to worry about. And that is probably just as ignorant, misinformed. So, biotech, it is complex, it's modern, right? It's a high technology thing. You know, we're involved every day in high technology, whether it's your cell phone or your computer or your food. There's an increased public interest in the natural world. We recognize that human society has been destroying the earth. You know, we're well past our natural holding capacity. We have over 6 billion humans on this planet, and the planet is designed to accommodate maybe 3, maybe 4 if we squeeze it. So, you know, we have an excess of at least a couple of billion humans that shouldn't be here. Right? We're way past natural. And most of our society is very interested in what's happening. What's happening to our environment? You know, we're polluting it. We're polluting it with humans. We have climate change is occurring. I don't think there's any question that climate change is occurring. The scientific community is divided on what's causing it. First of all, getting away from the politics of it all, if you talk to the scientists who are involved in climate change, they will say, yes, the climate is changing. We don't know, and this is crucial, we don't know whether it's just a natural fluctuation on the part of the Earth or whether it is actually something that, as a result of human activity. And secondary to that is we're not sure what to do about it, or whether we should do something about it. I mean, if it turns out to be just a natural fluctuation, is it appropriate for humans to try to interfere with that and climate change the other way to get it back to the way we want it to be? So some difficult questions. Biotech can be scary. All right? It brought back science fiction as a genre. Right? The attack of the killer tomatoes, nobody would accept that now. Right? It's just not plausible. Unless you genetically engineer the tomatoes and give them features to make them truly scary. Then you can suspend a certain amount of judgment and go watch the movie and enjoy it. But without the genetic engineering, you're probably not going to go watch that movie or read the book. With the genetic engineering, you have, as a result, all of these, not the one we just saw, but movies and books and so on that truly are scary based on simply genetic engineering, without going into further explanation as to why the story is scary. Why biotech, particularly genetically modified foods, is so scary is that it is visceral, right? We eat every day. If something happened and we found out that, you know, cell phones did cause brain cancer, we could live without them, right? You could give them up. You don't need your cell phone, but you can't give up food. So when you hear that people are mucking around with your food, you should be concerned about that. And you should be asking questions. How do you know what you're doing is safe and reasonable? We also have an associated problem with the development or the evolution of patents on life forms. Right? And a lot of people are very concerned about this, and not only from an ethical standpoint, but is it appropriate that a company or an individual, for that matter, can actually own a living thing? And the patent, and even though many people don't really understand what a patent is, it is kind of scary to think that, you know, for the first time ever, humans actually own a life form. I mean, beyond, you know, your pet dog or something. And another big scary factor is that the technology is completely dominated by a handful of big multinational corporations. It's probably not healthy for any industry to be so monopolized by three or four or five companies on a worldwide basis, and particularly when this involves food. So, what is it? You've already taken this. We'll skip through this quickly. Genetic modification, sometimes known as genetic engineering, sometimes known more generally, generically as biotechnology, any of several techniques used to add, delete, or amend genetic information in a plant, animal, or microbe. This is what's been going on through human hands for 10,000 years. Right? More specifically and recently, with genetic engineering, a more precise way to change the genetic structure at a molecular level, more directed to produce such things as pharmaceuticals, crops, industrial compounds, and so on. Right? The opportunities are almost limitless. History of genetic engineering, you've gone through this, so I'll skip through it pretty quickly. Recombinant DNA, or technically genetic engineering, began in 1973 with bacteria. The first commercial product was insulin from 1982. Now, insulin's an interesting story. This is human insulin, right? Human insulin taken from the human gene that makes insulin in our bodies and put into a bacteria. And, you know, sometimes you'll hear people say, I think it's unethical and inappropriate to transfer genes from one species to another. And typically what they're talking about is their tomato with a fish gene in it. Right? But here we have a real... There are no tomatoes with fish genes, by the way, at least not through genetic engineering. Nature may have done it, but no human has put fish genes into tomatoes and then into the marketplace. Here we have an example with insulin of where we're taking the most sacred organism, humans, and we're taking a piece of our own genetic information and giving it to the lowliest form of life, a bacterium, and forcing that bacterium to churn out a protein that the bacteria has no use for, insulin. Diabetics, almost all diabetics now who are dependent on insulin, are injecting genetically engineered human insulin. And this is an alternative to, of course, the insulin that used to be extracted from farm animals. The first food product, a cheese. Chymosin is a genetically engineered protein used in cheese making, vegetarian cheeses particularly. First released in the United Kingdom. A little bit surprising when we recognize that Europe generally, in the UK specifically, are much more skeptical of genetic engineering technology in the food supply. They were the first ones to start eating this stuff. The first crop was a Flavor Saver tomato, released in 94, was on the market for a while. The company that developed it, a small biotech company here in California, had some very good scientists who developed the technology quite quickly to make this tomato that was supposed to be delayed ripening, which means that it would not rot as quickly as regular tomatoes. The marketing was designed more for people in northern parts to provide them with a summer fresh taste in the middle of January. I tasted them, and I never had that impression. I mean, it's no longer on the market. It wasn't a particularly good product. Part of the reason was that they chose the wrong tomato variety to transform in the first place. The technology worked fine, right? It was a delayed ripening situation, but the tomato didn't. It wasn't a particularly tasty tomato in the first place. And secondly, the company, even though they were good in science, they weren't particularly good in production and marketing. So it failed in the marketplace, although they do say that they sold every tomato that they delivered to the market. And so far, there have been no documented cases of harm from GMOs. So really, the food products that we've been consuming for something over 10 years now, plenty of experience, still not a documented case of harm, although there have been some claims. Who uses the biotech products? Well, we already talked about the diabetics who are using genetically engineered insulin. A number of drugs, important drugs, have been developed through genetic engineering, and victims of cystic fibrosis are maintaining a healthy lifestyle into their 30s and 40s. I think previously, if you had cystic fibrosis, you were lucky to see your 20th birthday. And now people are into their 30s because of these, what are essentially miracle drugs that could not be produced any other way except through genetic engineering. Farmers, particularly in the U.S., the figures have gone up a little bit since your film, Bob. Soybeans is now 87% of the acreage. This is virtually saturation, right? When you consider the huge acreage of soybeans in this country and the huge number of farmers that grow soybeans, and take into account you have farmers who decide, farmers are independent businessmen and women, by and large. They make their own decisions on what they grow. And if they don't like something, they won't grow it next year. They'll buy your product from the competitor, or they'll go back to what they were growing before. But when you hit 87%, when you get that market share, take into account the number of farmers who support organic, which means they're not allowed to grow genetically modified varieties, the farmers who don't like the company selling it for whatever reason, the farmers who are very happy with what they were growing before, and they feel that they don't need to grow the genetically modified varieties. They're pretty well saturated now. Right. Any soybean farmer who's interested in growing or may grow genetically modified soybeans are already growing them. Cotton, 79% of the acreage. Again, a huge market share when you consider that these things have only been released in the last few years. Corn is now over half. Over half of our field corn, particularly, is of genetically engineered or biotech varieties. After that, it drops off considerably. Most of the canola is genetically modified. Papaya in Hawaii, there's a particular variety that's grown there and is dominant there, but nowhere else. And then squash and a couple of other smaller things. And then finally, crucially, farmers in developing countries are really the ones who are driving this technology now. You saw the desperation in the film, right? The need for producing more food, more nutritious food, safer food, particularly in developing countries. These are the farmers who are really clamoring after genetically engineered varieties. Something over 90% of farmers growing genetically engineered crops are poor subsistence level farmers in developing countries. Latest figures, there are now 21 countries growing genetically engineered crops. The U.S. is still the largest, followed by Argentina. Brazil, which came out of nowhere, I think 3 years ago, they were banned entirely. Even though they were legally banned, a lot of farmers still grew smuggled seeds that they got from Argentina. They took the chance of going to jail because, well, why? Because to the farmers, they were willing to take the chance because they saw the benefits of these new genetically engineered varieties. Canada, China, and India are also major producers. But new countries this past year just started growing GE foods for the first time. Portugal, France, Czech Republic, right? All European countries. Remember, Europe, and many people will still say this as part of the argument, Europe bans this technology. They don't grow any crops that are genetically engineered. Right? Well, that is not true. They don't grow a lot of them, and they're not widespread, but Germany has been, Spain has been now for several years, and as of 2005, we have Portugal, France, and the Czech Republic. Iran is also in there as a new country. They have introduced rice. So they are the first country to grow genetically modified rice. The other new products that are on the market and making an impact include things like corn with the stack traits. And I'm just indicating here, the BT is the insect-resistant trait, and the HR is for herbicide resistance. So a farmer growing a corn variety that has the BT and herbicide resistance will be able to grow a very clean crop, not have to worry so much about the corn borer insects particularly, and be able to control weeds with a single herbicide instead of a combination of several different ones. And this data just came out from the ISAAA, which you can look up in the books there to find them. They're online. The economics, you know, why are the farmers so interested in this? We had the National Center for Food and Agriculture Policy has been doing studies every second year for the last number of years looking at, you know, why are farmers adopting these technologies so rapidly. They looked at six crops, soybeans, corn, cotton, papaya, squash, and canola in the U.S. and found that the farmers were able to produce over 5 billion additional pounds of food and fiber on the same acreage, right? So without converting wilderness area or forest area or reserve area into farmland, they were able to dramatically increase the amount of food and fiber. Farm income, if you talk to the farmer, you know, what's crucial to the farmer is, you know, they're in business. They have to make an income. They're not doing it for the sheer joy of providing food. They've increased farm income by $1.9 billion spread across the farmers who are growing these things. And almost all farmers that I talk to are dedicated to stewardship and environmentally friendly farming as much as possible. And they've found that they've been able to reduce their pesticide usage by 46 million pounds each year. Right? These things occur each year. So when you talk to farmers, they're usually very happy to tell you why they're growing genetically engineered crops. In spite of the arguments they hear from the activists, some of the activists who say, you know, farmers will refuse to grow these crops because they're genetically engineered. Farmers are people, after all, right? They're members of society, and they have the same concerns, and they want to do the right thing. Well, you know, some of the anti-technology groups have been making that argument since 1993, saying there's no point releasing these things to farmers because the farmers will refuse to grow them. They say the same thing, you know, there's no point putting these things on the market because consumers will refuse to buy and eat them. Well, that also hasn't happened. Even in places where they have mandatory labeling, like in Europe, you know, I have no difficulty finding food labeled, you know, made with genetically engineered ingredients. There's no fanfare. There's no problem. They may not be the best sellers, but they're not at the bottom either. Some of the documented benefits. We already talked about some of the benefits that accrue to farmers and why they're happy growing the things. Increased yields, particularly in developing countries. Decreased chemical input costs. I was in the Philippines a couple of years ago, just after they had finished harvesting their first test of the BT corn, right? So insect-protected corn. And I was at a conference there, and somebody stood up and said, you know, we're getting a 30% yield increase with this BT corn. And I stood up and I said, well, you know, I hate to burst the bubble, but I really doubt that. I think somebody is being over-enthusiastic because these are the same varieties that American farmers are growing in the Midwest. Okay? They're not adapted to the Philippines. They're just, the seeds were brought over. They're the same seeds, different environmental conditions. And in the Midwest, the farmers don't see an increase of like 30%. It just doesn't happen. So why would the increase be so dramatic in the Philippines when these varieties were really bred in the first place for Nebraska and Iowa? And another Filipino scientist who was involved in the project stood up and said, well, you know, excuse me, sir, But I happen to know that those figures are real. In fact, it's a little bit more than 30% of yield increase in the Philippines. And she said, the reason that American farmers don't see the yield increase is that they grow it so that they don't have to spray insecticide to get their insect control. Right? The BT is built in. You don't need to spray insecticide. So the farmers in the U.S., they save because they don't spray insecticide. They save money because they don't have to buy the insecticide. They don't have to spray it. And then, you know, the yield potential from the corn is realized without with a minimum of insect damage. In the Philippines, our farmers, they can't afford to buy insecticide in the first place. So traditionally, they would plant their corn, the insects would come in and eat whatever they could, and the farmer harvested whatever the insects left behind. But with the BT corn, the insects are controlled. And in the absence of the insecticide being sprayed on it, the farmer still gets very good insect control because of the BT. And they are able to get this substantial increase in the yield compared with what they did in the past, which was simply to let the insects go ahead and eat the crop. Decreased chemical input costs. In the U.S., of course, if you don't have to spray insecticide, you don't have to buy insecticide. And if you ask a farmer, you know, what are their major concerns, they will say, you know, we don't want to spray any more chemicals than we absolutely have to, not only because of the environmental or health consequences, but because it's expensive. Right? Like any business, they don't want to have to spend any more on their inputs than any other business person. Mentioned in the film here, cleaner fields, less stockage on the product, which means if you don't have weeds, if you don't have insects, at the time of harvest, if you look in the bushel or the can, you're going to see clean grain, right? There's not going to be bits of weeds and weed seeds. You're not going to see the dirt getting in there because it doesn't blow around because of the reduced tillage and so on. So the farmer is able to deliver a higher quality product. It doesn't have to be cleaned, which is, of course, a cost. If you have to clean your grain because it has all of these weeds and weed seeds in it, that's an expense. They use less fuel because they're not running around the field on the tractor spraying chemicals all the time. They don't have to plow. With the reduced tillage, with the genetically engineered crops, the herbicide-tolerant crops, they don't have to plow to control the weeds. Less tillage, and there's fewer adverse health effects. Not so much in this country, but in China, where they've been growing now BT cotton for insect control. Insects love cotton, by the way, right? A major amount of pesticides go to control insects in cotton worldwide. Well, with the BT, of course, you don't need to spray those pesticides, those insecticides. And in China, when they introduced the BT cotton, they discovered that the rate of hospitalization of farm workers due to pesticide poisoning dropped dramatically. Right? The poorer farmers in China, of course, don't have the same safety standards as much of the rest of the world. So the farm workers, you know, they will buy pesticide, and they have to mix it up. Sometimes they'll just stick their arm into the barrel and mix up the pesticide with their arm, and then, you know, end up in the hospital and wonder why. Well, that doesn't happen anymore with the BT cotton. And it took a little bit of detective work to figure out that it's actually because of the BT cotton, not because of some other fortuitous event that allowed the farm workers to avoid the toxicity. Benefits to consumers. Right? This is an argument sometimes you'll hear that, well, okay, I'm not opposed to this technology, but what's in it for me? I'm not a farmer. Right? I'm a consumer. I want to buy healthy, safe, nutritious foods at reasonable cost. So why should I buy these GM products that are designed, you know, to be herbicide tolerant or insect protected? What good is that to me? Well, you have safer food, for one thing. Data coming in quite effectively establishing that when you eliminate the insects from the crop, you eliminate the opportunistic pathogens, fungi, that infect the crop based on the damage done, the injury done to the crop from the insects. Right? Plants are almost like animals or humans in this respect. When we're intact, you know, we're pretty well immune to most fungi or bacteria that happen to be floating around. We contact them all the time. But if you're injured, right, you have an opportunity for those pathogens to get into your system and then blow up into a disease. Plants are the same way. So if you have a corn plant, for example, and a corn borer comes along, the insect, and starts chewing on the corn, it injures a lot of tissue. And this injured tissue is like a nursery for fungal pathogens. These pathogens are floating around in the air. And most of the time, they land on the ground or they land on an intact leaf and nothing happens. They die eventually. But if they happen to land on an injured tissue, that tissue is where they start to grow. And that's where they cause the disease. In Africa and Asia, it's been noticed that where they've introduced BT corn particularly, the amount of mycotoxins, which are essentially toxins produced by fungi, right, myco, fungi, that has dropped dramatically. Because in the absence of the damage from the insects, because the insects are controlled by the BT, there's no place for these fungi to grow. The mycotoxins don't get into the food. They don't get into the mouths and stomachs of the consumer, and they don't dissolve the livers of the peoples who consume these things. This has been a major problem, particularly in Africa in the past, where there's a large consumption of corn, maize as they call it, and associated problems, particularly with things like liver disease, right? Because the liver is responsible for trying to clean up toxins in your body. Yeah, well, if you overwhelm your liver, then you get a problem. Yes, sir?
So what about introducing the BT toxin? Will the stomach degrade that?
The BT itself only works on the insect, right? If humans eat BT, we just digest it like a nutrient. And the same with anything else, you know, a cat. This is the same BT that's been used for over 50 years now commercially to control insects. And in fact, organic farmers use it because it's a naturally occurring insecticide. So we have a long history. We know it's safe, remarkably safe, actually. The only organism the BT has any effect on is the insect pest. And there are some different modifications made to be even more specialized. Some of the BTs are formulated to control the European corn borer. That's a primary one in the BT corn. Different formulations will affect the Colorado potato beetle, right? And that was developed for use in potatoes. And it works very well, except that product's also not on the market anymore. Safer food because of greater regulatory scrutiny. A genetically modified crop or food goes through a very extensive regulatory process, and it has to be supported by documentation that the food is at least as safe as what's already in the market. Whereas conventional new varieties, a plant breeder who mutagenizes a corn or a rice, most of our rice has been mutagenized using ionizing radiation, by the way, you probably didn't know that. That plant breeder, after ionizing radiation of the rice seeds, can grow up a new crop and develop a new variety and put that on the market without anybody saying anything or even looking at whether the nutrients have been changed or new toxins have been introduced. Now, most breeding companies and most breeders are conscientious enough that they will do those tests themselves, and they're not going to put something on the market unless they're pretty sure that they're safe and beneficial. But nonetheless, no government agency looks at them to just provide that additional oversight. With the genetically modified varieties, all of them are. Less pesticide, as they say. You know, one of the things that consumers will say is, I'm concerned about these chemicals in our food, about the pesticides and so on. And when they say to me, well, there's no benefit to me of these genetically engineered foods, and I say, well, you just said a few minutes ago that you'd really like foods that had less pesticides. There you go. Is that not a benefit? The companies, by the way, don't like using that argument. Right? The major argument in favor of the herbicide-tolerant and the BT crops is that the major benefit to consumers is the reduction in the pesticides. And the companies will not use that argument because they don't want to give the impression that pesticides are harmful in the first place. And then the environmental benefits. Again, consumers say, what's in it for me? You can point out some of the benefits to the environmental production with these genetically engineered crops that require less tillage. There's less soil erosion, not only from water, from the rain, but also wind. When in conventional farming, the farmer typically tills, and in organic farming, there's tillage to control the weeds, which means it digs up, it plows up the field. Right? This kills all the weeds, of course, very effectively, but the problem is that it exposes the soil to the rain erosion and also the wind. And if the wind comes up and blows off the topsoil, it's gone forever. To the environment, again, less pesticide going into the environment. The pesticides that are used with genetically engineered crops tend to be more modern, which means that they tend to be safer because there's a much greater regulatory scrutiny of them. Now, some people, of course, say, you know, chemicals are chemicals. Yes, sir?
Oh, I was just wondering what the pesticide level is comparable or how they compare to organic. Right, because organic farmers use some kind of pesticide.
Yeah. Organic farmers do indeed use pesticides. They tend to be the naturally occurring ones, right? So BT is itself a naturally occurring pesticide, but the difference is the farmers spray it over the entire field. And with the BT crop, the BT is built into the plant. Some of the chemicals that organic farmers use are extremely hazardous. They're copper compounds and so on. And there is certainly effort to get those off the market because they are hazardous. They are more toxic. Now, every chemical has a toxicity. Right? If you eat enough of it, you're going to get in trouble. I suggest that you have to consider what pesticide exactly are you talking about. And if it's something like glyphosate, which is a very popular herbicide, its toxicity is very small. Right? It's a very safe herbicide. It only works on plants. Just like the BT only works on certain insects, glyphosate only works on certain plants, right? And if we consume the glyphosate, it doesn't do us any harm. Now, I wouldn't recommend that. I mean, you treat all chemicals with respect. There are other chemicals, whether it's copper sulfate that the organic farmers use or something like paraquat, which conventional farmers use. Those are very nasty. And a much smaller amount of those things will start causing damage to you. So you really have to look at, what is the usage of the particular chemical? Some of them are very safe, some of them are very toxic. And, I can think of some that I would like to see off the market entirely. I don't think they're safe at all. But again, this is an issue that the industry doesn't want to discuss. And there is apparently a code of ethics among the companies that they will not compete based on our pesticide is safer than our competitors. They just have this agreement that they won't use that as an argument. But I think it's a legitimate thing that consumers should know about. Improved soil, we talked about this already. With the reduction in the tillage, the farmer doesn't have to plow up the fields. There's less erosion. The soil structure remains intact. There's more organic matter because the farmer can leave the trash from the previous year's crop, as you saw in the film earlier. And again, because the farmer isn't running around on the tractor over the fields all the time, he's burning less fuel. Increased biodiversity. This is an interesting one because, again, one of the arguments that we hear from anti-technology activists is that genetically engineered crops are a threat to biodiversity. And what's actually happening is that genetically engineered crops are increasing biodiversity in the farm. Right? This was a surprise. Nobody anticipated this until it started happening. And the reason for it is, let's take our farm full of BT corn as an example. Well, with the BT corn, the farmer doesn't have to spray insecticide, or at least not as much. So what that means is that in that cornfield, there are lots of other insects. As long as the insect doesn't start chewing on the corn plant, They can live in that field. They can burrow in the ground. They can eat the weeds. They can interact with, you know, the birds and other things. As long as they don't eat the corn, they can make a home in the cornfield. That increases biodiversity. A conventional cornfield, the farmer comes in, sprays the entire field with insecticide, and it wipes out not only the pests that eat the corn, but also the insects that just happen to be passing through or living there, not causing any damage. And that's, of course, a decrease in biodiversity. So, I mean, in retrospect, yeah, it makes sense. It's logical. But nobody really thought of this before it actually came out. And there's some sources here that you can look at to, if you want to track these figures down.
Related to biodiversity, is there any examples of...
So related to biodiversity, is there an example in the field of seeds spreading into nature and competing with the natural varieties?
Yeah, is there an example where seeds have escaped from the farm, got into unmanaged or wilderness areas, and caused a problem? Is that your question? Yeah, there are no such examples. Now, that doesn't mean it can't happen. But when you consider that over the course of plant breeding for 10,000 years, humans have weakened those plants so much that when they escape from the farm, they can't really establish populations. Right? One of the most common things that humans have done to plants over the years is remove, through breeding, conventional breeding, things like the naturally occurring pesticides, because they tend not to taste very good. Right? So we humans like our vegetables to taste good. And if they have pesticides, the naturally occurring ones inside, or artificial ones sprayed outside, we don't like the taste of those. So the breeding effort has been to eliminate a lot of those chemicals. Now, those chemicals actually protected the plant from things eating it, including humans. So in nature, and around the world 10,000 years ago, before humans started mucking around, those same plants would be producing these chemicals, and that would keep things from eating it. Okay, now, jump forward to today. When your celery seeds and escapes off the farm and starts growing in the roadside or in the reserve, the animals and insects find that and say, this is great, this tastes wonderful. Right? It gets selected against pretty quickly. It can't compete with the other plants that are still putting out these chemicals, the anti-feed and things. Does that answer your question?
Yeah.
Okay, so why are people complaining about GMOs when all of these benefits seem to be accruing to farmers, to consumers, and the environment? Well, a number of arguments. Genetic engineering is unnatural. Right? Nature never allows genes to cross from one species to another. You hear this all the time. It's not true, but you hear it. And people use this as a basis for determining that they don't like this technology. Genetically engineered food contains bacterial genes. And people will say, well, bacteria, we don't want to eat bacteria. I mean, that's yucky. If it has bacteria, that means it's gone off, right? It's rotten. That they spread uncontrollably. Just your point. They escape from the farm, they get into wild areas or refuges, and become weeds. Well, again, that hasn't happened. Conceivably, it could. If a genetic engineer puts a fitness trait into a food crop, something that would give it an enhanced fitness to make it compete with those wild plants more effectively, then yes, that could potentially cause problems. But so far, nobody has done that, and really, there's no reason why anyone would do that. It's unethical. Right? It's not a scientific argument. It's not due to safety, but we just don't think God wants us to do this kind of stuff. This is Prince Charles' major argument. It's risky. Right? Genetic engineering is risky, but very vague. We're not sure what is the risk you're concerned with. And controlled by corporate interests. Again, not a scientific issue, but certainly one of importance to us in society. Is it appropriate to have a handful of companies essentially owning all of this technology and controlling the food supply? And sometimes you hear that the crops are simply not regulated, there's no prior scrutiny. Again, not true, as we'll see, but It is something that motivates people to get out there and campaign against the technology. Okay, there are legitimate concerns with GMOs. There are legitimate concerns with any technology. And if society is going to benefit from the use of the technology, we have to be able to identify what the real risks are and manage them somehow. And if the real risks are too scary, then of course you ban the technology. But if there is benefit to the technology and the risks are manageable, then they move forward. Okay, what are the concerns with GMOs? First, the environment. It is possible to genetically engineer a plant to make it a risk to the environment. As we just said, if we gave it a fitness trait, if we gave it the ability to compete with other plants more effectively, and particularly wild plants, it could become a dangerous weed. It could take over large tracts of land, and we don't want to see that happen. So the scientific community investigating GMOs is deeply concerned about the environment. The second aspect is health safety. Again, it is legitimately a concern that a person, a genetic engineer, could put a toxin into a food that doesn't ordinarily contain that toxin, right? And then the food, of course, becomes hazardous. Now, you could say, and some people have said, that, well, you know, who would do that? Well, nobody. But sometimes you can do it unintentionally, either because you don't know that the gene for the protein that you're putting in there is toxic, or it might be an entirely innocuous gene or protein in the host species, but when it gets into the new species, it somehow interacts with something that's already there and turns it into a toxin. Right? So those are legitimate concerns, and those are the questions that the regulatory agencies ask before they give approval. Now, in addition to these scientific areas, there are several non-scientific areas driving people's opposition to the technology. The ethical or cultural. Right? A number of people will say, like Prince Charles, that, you know, this is meddling in God's domain and we have no business doing that. They may say, like the Maoris of New Zealand, that this is meddling with nature and we shouldn't do that. The traditional Aboriginal Hawaiians, of course, consider taro to be sacred and we can't do anything to taro. You know, that's fine. Those are, again, they're not scientific, but they're perfectly legitimate in our free society to make those determinations and not pursue a given technology if it goes against our ethics or cultural norms. There are socioeconomic concerns. Some people feel that genetically engineered crops will benefit big farmers at the expense of small farmers, right? I mean, we're losing small family farms and we should be supporting these small family farms, but biotechnology seems to be of greater benefit to the big farmers, and so that obviously will threaten the small family farms. Well, I can understand where that concern comes from. As it happens, biotech crops do not seem to be size dependent. And if anything, it's the smaller farmers who are benefiting from the technology. All farmers are benefiting from the technology or they wouldn't continue to grow it, point one. But secondly, it does seem to be the smaller farmers who are benefiting more. And think of the Filipino farmers who can't afford insecticide. They get to grow the BT corn, and even though they don't have insecticide, they have insect control. Political issues, a number of things here. International, you know, in the international marketplace, trade is always contentious, and our trading partners sometimes will not come out and say that, you know, we don't want to support GMOs from your farmers, right? We don't want to buy them. We want you to buy our agricultural products, but we don't want to buy yours. They don't actually say it that way. It is hidden in covert terms. And similarly, covert technological, and finally, fear, right? Some people are fearful of the technology, and once you have fear in place, it's very difficult to have a rational, informed debate. We've known this now for some time. This is one of our most popular news magazines. You'll notice this was, 26 years ago, 25 years ago. so prescient on the part of the National Enquirer, right? They knew this was coming in 1980. They knew it was coming. They could have the same headline today, right? In fact, they could have several of the same headlines today. I mean, you want to be a millionaire? Just solve these common problems, right? How did they know that 25 years later, you know, this would be the basis of one of our most popular TV game shows? The three common problems, by the way, and anybody could do this, you know, world peace, world poverty, world injustice, right? You overcome those things and you'll be a millionaire. No big problem. So fear, right? This is scary stuff. And these genetic engineers are in their labs, you know, mucking around with the genes of these things, and who knows what they're going to create. Generally, with non-scientists, and some scientists as well for that matter, we can divide the concerns, we can overcome these concerns with two basic issues. One is context, right? Very often, when I get into a discussion with somebody who's either very pro-genetic engineering or very anti-genetic engineering, they haven't put the issues into the context. I'll get to that in a minute. And the other thing is, they tend not to apply critical thinking. Now, critical thinking means good, healthy skepticism. It means not basing your determination on wishful thinking or beliefs, but instead on evidence. And not selective evidence, but all of the available evidence. Things that will support your preferred position and things that will tend to refute your preferred position. Use of pesticides in agriculture. Okay, this is not new with genetic modification. This has been around for 50 years. People are concerned about pesticides. They have this really deep-seated fear of pesticides. Sometimes that fear is valid, sometimes it isn't. But when people have a fear of the pesticides, they're just not thinking clearly and making the points that, okay, just what is this pesticide? Is it a relatively safe one? Is it a relatively hazardous one? How widespread is it? Does it end up in the food, or is it sprayed on the crop very early on and then degrades long before the foods are harvested? Those questions don't get addressed. The same people tend to say, well, natural products are safe because nature made them, or God put them there. Therefore, they're okay. Wrong. So we saw from the film, Bruce Ames pointed out that the majority of pesticides are actually naturally occurring in the foods we eat every day. Right? Synthetic pesticides, the ones that humans make, account for a very, very tiny proportion of the total pesticides we eat. And we still have not, humans have still have not synthetically made anything nearly as lethal as what nature has made. Some of the toxins produced naturally without any human involvement whatsoever are far more toxic than the worst things that humans have come up with. And then a corollary to that point is, if they're natural, they're safe, and subsequently, if they're synthetic, they can't be safe. So all synthetic pesticides are unsafe and we have to avoid them. This is the thinking. Toxicology doesn't matter. It doesn't matter that one chemical is more or less toxic than another, right? The people just don't get to that point. This is part of the context that you need to incorporate, you know, when you're out trying to decide, you know, what products you're going to support, whether it's a food, an industrial product, a new car, whatever. These questions you have to debate for yourselves and decide scientifically whether they, first of all, are safe according to your standard, and secondly, fit into your cultural norms, ethical norms. All chemicals are not equally hazardous, but people who have this mindset believe that they are. They're a chemical, right? Even something as simple as H2O, it sounds like a chemical, so it has to be hazardous. And indeed, H2O kills thousands of people every year. Finally, amount doesn't matter. You know, any amount is too much. Toxicologists say that everything is toxic, it just depends on the dose, as to whether it's going to be hazardous to you or not. And this is a good maxim to live by. We eat toxins every day. We eat these naturally occurring pesticides. We eat synthetic pesticides. And unless we get too much of them, they don't cause us any harm. There are certainly nutrients that are toxic, right? Zinc, for one, mineral, right? Naturally occurring. We eat it in all of our foods. If we didn't have any zinc at all, that would be very unhealthy. If we have too much zinc, that is also very unhealthy. It's all a question of context, and it's a question of just how much we're actually eating. I was trying to get this point across. Think of how to explain to people this context thing. I was driving through Nebraska one year, and came across this billboard where, you know, the company, Syngenta in this case, was trying to convey the idea that, you know, a farmer is growing a cornfield here. He sprays it once, he or she sprays it once to control the insects, and people are deathly afraid of eating the corn from that cornfield from this conventional farmer. But at the same time, you know, we have this lady sitting at home with this can of what may well be the same insecticide, spraying it for the same reasons, and she thinks nothing of it. And this is, I think, a great illustration of context. If this lady is going to be concerned about one dose of pesticide on this crop several months before she sees the food, why is she not equally concerned about this dousing herself with chemical? And think about this for yourself for a moment. How many chemicals do you actually encounter during the course of the day? I mean, you probably count up a fair number of them. More context. Risk. Right? We had a situation just a year and a half ago in Virginia. Right? Pregnant lady, Melissa Williamson, sitting in her home, and all of a sudden, the city decides to dig up the street in front of her house to do some repairs. And she is very concerned about the sounds of these jackhammers. Right? Apparently, nobody has ever done any research on loud noises like jackhammers on the development of the fetus. And of course, as a concerned mother-to-be, she wants to know, right, are these noises, the city digging up the street, is that going to cause problems for my baby? Well, sure, like any concerned parent, you're going to ask that question, demand some answers. Now, you might ask yourself, in the context of GMOs, do you think Ms. Williamson will be willing to try feeding GMO baby food to her child? In all likelihood, you'd say, probably not, because she's heard scary things about GMOs. She's heard that, you know, nobody's proven it to be safe. Doesn't matter that nothing has ever been proven to be safe, but nevertheless, why would you take the chance, right? Why take that risk? Even if you agree that it's a small risk, why would you take the risk? As a concerned parent, I don't want to have anything go wrong with the development of my baby. So, you know, here we have a concerned mother-to-be worried about the jackhammer noise on the street in front of her house, and she probably does not realize just how damaging other things in her life are to her unborn child. Right? But she probably would say, I'm never going to feed GMO baby food to my child. So let's get into how a scientist and a non-scientist would approach these difficult questions, right? First of all, we start with a non-scientist. Tend to be selective. You start with a conclusion. You say, you know, I heard GMOs are dangerous. Okay, let's take that at face value. I'm going to investigate. And what they do is go out looking for evidence to support that predetermined conclusion. Right? And this is called, we call this cherry picking. Right? You selectively choose the data that supports your position. And this is kind of human nature. If somebody comes up with alternative evidence, instead of accepting it and say, okay, well, let's take this evidence, we'll put it on the table, we'll evaluate it, we'll weigh it pro and con, instead of doing that, they say, oh, no, you did the experiment wrong. Or, you know, that evidence comes from the company and they paid for it, right? They paid somebody to fabricate evidence to support their view. Often lacks context. Right? I hope I've got this point across. Context is so crucial on these things. You look at a single issue from a single perspective. You're lacking the context. You say GMO crops can spread their pollen, right, and contaminate the farmer next door. Well, that's absolutely true. The crops produce pollen, The wind carries the pollen. Insects carry the pollen. So therefore, this is a legitimate reason to ban GMOs. Well, hold it now. The context is that all crops do this. And the question you should be asking is, do the GMO crops do it more than the conventional version? Scientific approach, in contrast, and I'm sure Bob will go through this with you if he hasn't already, a scientist does not start with a conclusion. Starts perhaps with a question, maybe an idea, a hypothesis, and then says, okay, well, how do I get to the truth? Right? I mean, science is, after all, simply a search for the truth. What is it actually? I want to know the answer. I don't care if it goes against my preconceived notions or preferences. I just want to know what are the facts. And then you design your experiments, you collect the evidence, and you don't even consider a conclusion until you have sufficient evidence to cover all of the bases. And many times, scientists can't come to a conclusion because the evidence does not support a particular conclusion. The evidence may be good. You may have done the experiments correctly and acquired useful information, but still not enough to lead you to a conclusion. And you hope that you or one of your colleagues or somebody else will pick up that question and develop more evidence and eventually come to a conclusion. But just because you don't come to a conclusion doesn't mean it's a failure. Actively, the scientist actively seeks alternative conclusions. And this is why we have the peer review system. This is why, when we develop a set of experiments, we write a manuscript, we want to share it with the world. Before we share it with the world, we share it with our closest friends and say, look at this and tell me, am I on the right track? Am I missing something? Be as critical as you can be with me, because I'd rather you, my friend and colleague, do it than have it go out to the world and have the rest of the world polarize me. We are our own greatest critics as scientists. You come to complete an experiment, you collect the data, you start writing up the results, discuss the implications of the work, and you probably spend more time trying to find, what did I do wrong? How can this data be interpreted differently from the way I've written it up? This is not human nature to do this, because it does involve a lot of introspection and a lot of self-criticism. But it turns out to be effective because the scientific community... No, I'm not here. Scientific community, over the years, has turned out to be the most effective means of providing accurate information on the way the universe is. It has provided, science has provided the most accurate means of predicting what will hold in the future. Right? I mean, you can use a crystal ball or a clairvoyant and get all sorts of predictions as to what will happen in the future, and sometimes they're right. And sometimes we focus on when the clairvoyant is right or the crystal ball is right, and we say, wow, there must be something to this. But you ignore all the times when they're wrong. The scientist and the scientific community has had the best track record. It's not perfect, but it has had the best track record at figuring out and trying to make some prediction as to what's going to happen into the future. And generally applies critical thinking skills. Again, context, critical thinking. You don't have to be a scientist to do this. I mean, this is good for anybody, right? Any kind of question, deciding whether to get married, that's not a scientific question. But you want to apply both context and critical thinking before you come to a conclusion. Okay, comparing, getting back to GMOs and crop production, traditional crops and modern crops. All new crops are genetically modified, right? The crop has to have a change in its DNA. If a new crop does not have a change in its DNA, that means it's just the old crop masquerading. So a new crop variety, if you're a plant breeder, you want to introduce your new wheat or rice or whatever, it has to be genetically different, that means genetically distinct. It has to be uniform so that when you grow a field full of these things, all of the plants look pretty much the same. Right? If you have some tall plants and some short plants, that isn't going to work. You're not going to get a new crop registered for commercial sale. And finally, it has to be genetically stable, which means that year after year, each seed generation has to produce essentially the clone of the parent line. And this was one of the early concerns. You don't hear this very much anymore about genetic engineering technology, that, well, maybe it's unstable. The genes are unstable. You've introduced this new piece of DNA. It will destabilize the genome. That we don't hear that argument anymore, I think largely because it has been. Okay, let's go through this. One of the examples, most of our wheat varieties actually have natural foreign DNA in them. Here's some of the chromosomes of wheat in red, and through this fluorescent staining, you can see some rye fragments. Right? Nature did this. Now, this is, you know, you heard about this in the film. This is a dossier that I needed. I've produced with my colleagues both conventional new crop varieties and genetically engineered new crop variety, one of them. This is what the dossier looks like going to the regulatory agencies for the conventional variety. But if you have a genetically engineered crop, you have to provide several different other things to at least three different agencies, normally three different agencies in the U.S. They require distinct, uniform, and stable information, as well as a bunch of other things. And I don't expect you to read this. But they ask these questions that they don't ask for the conventional varieties. All right? So it's very easy, relatively easy, to get a new variety conventionally. But this is what it took to get the genetically engineered variety through the regulatory approval process itself. Now, you know of some methods of genetic modification? I've segregated out recombinant DNA because it is genetic engineering. And everything else below it are different forms of conventional breeding. The National Academy panel I worked on the health aspects came up with this chart where we tried to investigate what is the likelihood of something unusual happening that could be hazardous, right? Could be risky. And we looked at different forms of breeding, and again, I don't really expect you to read this fully, but we looked at different forms with the likelihood, a chart here showing what is the likelihood of something adverse happening unexpectedly. And you can see here that we have several different types of recombinant DNA technologies, and they can tend to be, you know, dispersed within the broad range. So there is no legitimate reason to segregate out genetic engineering from other forms of breeding technology. Some examples, herbicide-tolerant canola. If you're a canola farmer and you want to control weeds with herbicides, and you pretty well have to because weeds devastate canola, you have a choice of several different types of herbicides and varieties that you could use depending on the types of weeds you have, the companies you like, and so on and so forth. And all of these are different herbicides, and these are the categories of herbicides. Some of these are naturally occurring. Some are introduced through genetic engineering. Some of them are introduced through conventional breeding. They're all herbicide tolerant, right? Plants have naturally occurring herbicide tolerance. This is not unique to genetic modification. So we have several different types here. These two in the bottom are both genetically engineered. They add an additional option for farmers, right? And if the farmers couldn't grow these, they'd grow one of these and spray one of these chemicals. It's up to the farmer to choose, and they have been. Different processes to end up with the same product. A couple of examples here, rice and canola, right? We can develop new varieties of rice or canola, one with rice with disease resistance from the XA21 gene. You can introduce that either conventionally through traditional breeding or through genetic engineering. The final product is what's crucial, all right? Not the method of breeding, but if rice with an XA21 gene for disease resistance is hazardous, well, that's fine, but it's hazardous both for the conventionally developed one and for the genetically engineered one. Similarly with the canola, a farmer can choose for sulfonylurea resistance, if that's the herbicide they want to use, from either a conventional one or a genetically engineered one. And other things that aren't yet on the market, different examples of things that you could develop either using genetic engineering technology or conventional technology. Okay, changes. When you introduce a piece of DNA into a plant, the amount of DNA is usually very tiny. You're talking about, you know, one gene added to a genome of, you know, 25,000, 30,000 genes. It's not a big deal. The additional gene is a tiny fragment, but the amount of DNA is so variable from one species to another, again, it's insignificant to even try to figure it out. I did for one of my plants that I engineered, and it was 0.000007% new DNA. DNA is not an issue. We eat it all the time. It's in all our foods. The protein could be, right? The gene codes for, provides a recipe to make a protein in the plant that the plant ordinarily would not make. At least this is the intent of genetic engineering technology. That protein could be an allergen, it could be a toxin, or it could be just an ordinary protein useful as a nutrient. But again, the amount of protein added is usually very small, right? Insignificant. This is the chart that the Academy report came up with as to how we should evaluate new products. And I'm just going to point out the top box. It says newly modified organism. It doesn't say genetically engineered. It doesn't say biotech product. It says new modified organism. It doesn't matter whether it was produced using gene technology or conventional breeding. Conclusions of that study: foods with altered substances, novel substances or altered level, they should all be regulated. Somebody outside the breeding institution or the company should take a look just to make sure it's okay. And any new modified food, whether genetically engineered or otherwise, if the composition is similar to something that's already out there, then it probably requires very little regulatory scrutiny. And this is the consensus of the scientific societies worldwide, including in Europe, US, Brazil, India, China, and so on. The method of breeding is immaterial, right? Apply your critical thinking skills. The method is immaterial. If you're going to get sick, it'll be from the product. The resulting thing, the thing that results from your action of whatever breeding method you use. And there's no scientific justification to single out genetic engineering. Consequences of poor public understanding. We have a lot of topical political issues, right? In the old days, you didn't have to be a scientist. You didn't have to know anything about science, right? I mean, the telephone was probably, you know, to our great-grandparents, the telephone was probably the height of technology. And you didn't need to worry too much about that. But nowadays, there are a lot of questions. They appear in the paper every day, whether it's stem cell research or cloning, nanotechnology, so on and so forth. These all involve some understanding of science. You don't have to be a scientist or a technical expert to be able to ask questions about these things using the critical thinking and context ideas. And then you can be an informed citizen and make reasoned determinations on whether to support or not support these different issues. Public opinion drives policy, of course, and if you're scientifically ignorant, like most of the people who took that survey at the beginning of my presentation, you're going to end up making bad decisions. I mean, even decisions that would go against your own better interests because you don't understand what the question really is. I'll just skip through these. I think we're running out of time. Oh, I do want to mention, I was in the Philippines. I do a lot of teaching judges, right? Judges deal with litigation in the courts that involve nowadays science, DNA forensics, right? Anybody watch CSI? Look at the amount of science involved in that. And the judges are very scared because most judges don't have a science background. So they want to learn a little bit about science. So they invite people like me to come and talk to them. And I was at in the Philippines at the invitation of the Philippine Supreme Court to talk to their judges in kind of a workshop like this. And I had one judge who put up his hand during the question period, and he said, "Can you tell me why is it that when a man walks through a BT cornfield, he becomes gay?" This was a judge, right? Educated, intelligent, but woefully uninformed. In Zambia, people are dying because the president, Levi Wanawasa, decided that GM food was poison. And we're not going to give our people, even though they're starving to death, we're not going to give them this poison corn from the U.S., and people died because of that decision. Other people broke into the warehouse. It was already delivered. It was part of the food aid package. It was held in warehouses in Zambia. And the president said, "We're not going to open the warehouses because we're not going to give our people poison." Well, some people broke into some of those warehouses anyway. They ate the food and lived. South Africa, I was just in South Africa in December. Devastating. HIV/AIDS. You go to a town meeting there or something, you'll see plenty of old people, you'll see plenty of young people, and you'll see a reasonable number of young women, right, in their teens and 20s. Very few men of that age because of the devastation of HIV/AIDS. Well, somebody's decided it was, you know, a folk cure for AIDS. If you have AIDS, if you're a young man with AIDS, there's only one cure: sex with a virgin. Sex with a virgin. And obviously, the public health implications of that belief, there's no evidence, obviously, to support it. It's a belief, but a deeply held belief for some people. Think about it. And in North Africa, primarily in Muslim communities, GM food has been modified by the CIA from the U.S., right, to sterilize people so that there will be fewer Muslim families having children. Again, a belief. There's no evidence to support this, but it's what people believe. And they make their decisions on what they're going to eat based on their beliefs. Closer to home, I'm going to skip over this one. Even closer to home. Anybody from Mendocino? We have, in our northern county, a couple of years ago, a ballot initiative to ban the cultivation of GMOs. Right? There was a lot. I was involved to some extent in this, trying to give people background information. But the measure passed. Right? So now in Mendocino, GMO, a farmer who wants to grow, you know, BT corn isn't allowed to do that because in Mendocino, the GMOs are banned from cultivation. You can still eat the foods, but you can't grow them. Well, one of the problems, I mean, this is okay, right? I believe in democracy. If people have informed debate and they determine they don't want to have GMOs in their community, fine. But as an educator, I want you to have good information, accurate information, and then have a debate and come to a reasoned determination, right? That's what democracy is to me. And if it isn't, then you're threatened. You're threatening democracy itself. Well, the good people of Mendocino passed this motion. They decided they were going to ban GMOs, and at the same time, they legally redefined DNA as a protein. Among other things, the language of the ballot initiative defined DNA as a protein. Now, I hope you recognize the fallacy of this. And I hope you recognize that I'm not going to go through it. I mean, we're out of time, but I wanted to illustrate this point anyway, that an entire policy, right, a democratic victory for a policy is based on very bad information. And this is going to come back eventually to bite them. Finally, when you encounter concerns with GMOs from people, ask yourself, is the concern science or non-science? Try to identify where they're coming from. Science tends to be product-oriented, and it is evidence-based. So demand evidence, peer-reviewed evidence particularly. Ask how it compares with the status quo, right? This is the context. When you hear that, yes, pollen flows from GM plants, well, ask, does pollen not also flow from conventional plants? And if it does, then what's the difference? Is there more pollen in the GM plant? Maybe there is, maybe there isn't. You need to get the evidence to answer that. And essentially, apply critical thinking and context, right? Pound this in over and over again. So you need to evaluate all the evidence, not just the selective evidence. With that, I see we're after 6 o'clock. I'm going to give up.
Thank you, Alan. You heard many of the themes that I have been preaching to you about critical thinking and science, and now perhaps you'll even have a greater appreciation when I say what's the alternative explanation for those experiments. We have some munchies, some really good ones right outside the door, and what I'd like to do, because the time is running late, if Alan doesn't mind, if there's any pressing questions right now that we can answer in a couple of minutes, we'll take it. And if not, Alan and I are happy to address all of your questions right outside the room after class. So are there any pressing questions that you're just dying to ask? And I mean that, that just, or any comments or criticisms or contrarian views or anything else, we're happy to listen.
And if you think of something later on, feel free to phone them at home.
Absolutely. Melissa.
Yeah, I had a question about what happened in Zambia. Mm-hmm. Have there been other cases that are similar to that, where governments have reacted in that way?
Yes, but that is the most outrageous, really. I mean, because that really did cost people's lives. And that's the example a number of us use. If you know, if a government decides that you know they want to ban GMOs like Mendocino, right? I mean, nobody's going to die because of that, right? But Zambia is the worst case. There are some other African countries that have followed suit, but fortunately, they were not in the dire consequences of having mass starvation. But there are some other African countries that have similarly banned GMOs. And there are some other African countries that have adopted them. South Africa is moving forward very quickly with BT corn.
I think the real point here is that this kind of ignorance and prejudice is really affecting real people. This is not just something which, you know, you can't buy it at Whole Foods in Westwood and that's okay. I mean, it really is affecting real people because of this ignorance. Any other questions? Let's thank Alan once again. And what I'd like you to do is to introduce yourselves to him outside.